My guest today is Judy Vaughan, founding director of Alexandria House, a transitional residence and neighborhood center supporting women and children in need since its establishment in 1996 in LA. Throughout her career, Judy has received numerous awards, including recognition as a Woman of Justice by Network and as a Woman of the Year by the LA County Commission for Women. Judy was challenged by her colleagues and peers at the University of Chicago. They told her if she truly wanted to work for change, she had to be grounded in the life experience of people struggling to survive. After completing a PhD in religious social ethics from the University of Chicago, Judy made the bold decision to resign from Mount St. Mary's College and took a job as director at the LA House of Ruth, setting on a path of unwavering commitment to social change. Without further ado, let's listen to Judy's inspiring journey from her first hand. Hi, Judy. Welcome to Atlanta Diaries. And I'm really grateful for all the work that you're doing.
Thank you. And it was great to meet you through a mutual colleague and friend. And I've enjoyed even our brief conversations today. So thank you for having me be a part of this.
Absolutely. So Judy's, why don't you share with us what were your early years like and what motivated this transition from an anthropology professor to the director of LA House of Ruth?
Yes. Well, I have to always remember my family and thank them. I identify myself now as a cultural Catholic, but service and faith and belief in the connection among all of us, in old terms, we're all a piece. We're all one, even though we have different skills and talents and personalities and life experiences. And that was a very important part of my growing up. I have two sisters. I'm the youngest in my family. And I have to really laugh sometimes because we were all three girls. And it was my mom and my dad who really told each of us that we could be and do whatever it is that we feel called to do. You expressed it so well in your introduction about the importance of who gets to write the narrative in terms of the work that we do. But as a woman who belongs to a religious community, when the four church women were murdered in El Salvador for standing with those who are dealing with just survival against genocidal forces, against economic oppression, that really struck many of us in a religious community about how seriously and how willing we were to live out our faith. And then I remember this conversation with a woman I call my mentor and mother in the movement, Margie Tewitt. Judy, what do you want to be? Do you want to be liberal or you want to be radical? And I think any of us who take Jesus' work and life seriously, there's really only one answer to that. And that has to be radical. So putting all those things together led to my decision to resign from the college and really ground myself more in the experiences that we're struggling every day to survive.
While you said that, you know, your parents brought you up believing that do what you feel like, did you sort of have a chat with them and consult them? I know maybe coming from a society where parents play a very large role or believe they want to play a very large role. So I don't know if it makes sense, but that question comes to my mind as well.
No, it makes a lot of sense. And actually, my dad tried to bribe me not to enter a religious community right after high school, knowing that I was still young and there's so much to life to experience. And he wrote me a letter that talked about don't choose a safe vocation, because we're talking about graduating in 1963.
Yeah.
You know, there weren't a lot of options for women as much as there are now. So his challenge was not to choose a safe vocation. But probably about 20 years later, he acknowledged how I was living my life was anything but safe. And we had some good discussions around that.
And how did he make peace with it?
He sometimes, and my mom as well, wished that maybe I had chosen a different vocation that would be not quite as radical. You know, I belong to a group called Women of Conscience. And especially in the 80s, we did civil disobedience on a regular basis. It was before 9/11. So we usually did an action once a month to really get media and raise awareness about what was happening throughout Central America. And so the first time I did an action, my mom saw it on TV before I told her because I didn't want her to worry. So she said, okay, Judy, I know you feel you need to do this kind of thing, but could you just possibly give me a warning so I don't see you on television? So, you know, my parents really, I just am grateful to them and who they were, and unconditional love. I know not everybody experiences.
And on another note, Judy, the fact that you took on teaching, right? And your background is commendable, you know, double masters and PhD. So did that ever cross your mind that where will that go?
Yeah, that's a great question. And just to throw in, I got accepted to the University of San Francisco to be the first class of women at that university to go into nursing. Mm-hmm. I always thought I'm going to be a nurse.
Right.
And for anybody who's the youngest in their family, maybe they would understand this. My oldest sister also became a nun in the same religious community. And as the youngest, I got tired of hearing, oh, little miss me too. So I just said, I am going to be a nurse. I'm going to live my life differently than especially my oldest sister. But that call, it was to really join the Sisters of St. Joseph. And everything seemed to me in a lot of ways to just fit in my own journey in becoming who I am today. And I have to tell you, Vatican II hadn't happened yet in the Catholic faith. So it was pretty strict when we entered the convent, like not watching news, not listening to the radio. I mean, we had to leave the classrooms because of bomb threats on the campus. So I was the only woman in a class of 40 at the University of Chicago in social ethics. And my colleagues in my division really taught me so much because it was an international group, many of whom had been involved in their own political struggles in their home countries. So I've just been really so grateful for the experiences in my life that really have kept me motivated and challenged and aware of some of the things that are happening in the world. That growing up in an economically stable, intact family, my education lacked a lot. Maybe academically it might not have, but in terms of real life struggle, it all sort of came together for me.
A protected childhood in a sense, right?
Yes, yes.
You didn't come from a place of entitlement. That could have been one sort of route you had taken versus from a place of humility and, you know, thinking that I need to learn more and do more and pay back in a sense.
Yeah. And you know what? I have to attribute that to my mom and dad, because my mom grew up in a working poor class and my dad came from a long line of attorneys. My mom would have been valedictorian at her high school, but she had to do the business kind of route, not the going to four-year college route, to support her family. And my dad constantly reminded his three daughters that the smartest one in our family was our mom, and degrees don't make you who you are. And I really, really appreciate that. And for a white person, then helps me understand better some of the dynamics of racism and to be more aware in terms of who I am and what I say and decisions I make.
Shifting gears, Judy, you know, I'd love to sort of now delve into your journey from LA House of Ruth to Alexandria House. I know it's a long journey of many decades, but, you know, if you can give us some headlines. Yeah.
So most of the folks were coming and fleeing from Central America's genocidal happenings. House of Ruth seemed to be in good shape. So I made the decision to go to Nicaragua, where at that time, the Contras were engaged in trying to overthrow the legitimately elected president, and people were being killed even in their hometowns, their little villages, and also while they were out picking coffee. Coffee is a major industry in Nicaragua. one of our sisters was already living in Jalapa. And so I went to live in Jalapa to accompany folks, especially as they were out in the fields picking coffee. Since the death of the four churchwomen in 1980, there was a little bit more awareness in the United States. So I think I was hoping and thought, and we're being told that the presence of a United States person, especially someone who's white, can help protect those who are just trying to live their daily lives. I did terrible picking coffee, awful. I was outpicked by a 4-year-old who taught me how, and then filter basket probably 3 times faster than I ever did. And my Spanish still was not great. So the woman that I mentioned who asked me the question about being radical or liberal actually was the head of a national organization called NAR, National Assembly of Religious Women. And she died unexpectedly at 65 of cancer. And I had been on the board of that organization, and they needed someone to take the lead relatively quickly. And I had come to an awareness that I possibly could do more effective work back in the States. And that's how I got back to Chicago the second time and served as the director of NAR. And I'm really proud of the work we did there because a number of Catholic organizations of women really had not looked seriously at racism. And that's how I came to do the multicultural look at racism workshops.
And from there, how did Alexandria House start?
So I finished my work at NAR, and while working at Women for Guatemala, it was during the time of the O.J. Simpson trial.
Right.
And I was watching TV with a friend of mine, and the newscaster said, "Okay, the car is getting off in the chase. The car was getting off on Wilshire," and I'm screaming at the screen, "No, it's sunset. It's sunset." And my friend Nancy said, "You know, Judy, I think it's time you go home." And at about the same time, I got a call from another friend that Immaculate Heart Community had a house that they wanted to use for women and children. And I thought to myself, I want to use that house. And so through talking with some of the members of the community, I flew out and had an interview and shared a vision. And they said yes. So I came back to LA and moved in here May 1st, 1996. And that's how Alexandria House started. And it really started because I invited 13 people who had come through different life experiences, different cultural backgrounds, to come one time only, come for dinner. And that group pretty much stayed on forever. In fact, we still have 3 of our founding members on the board 28 years later. I think for me, what happened here was I got to witness miracles. I got to see radical change in individual lives. But I also got to hear the obstacles and really some of the horror stories that women have had to overcome in order to create the kind of life they want for themselves and for their kids. Alexandria House has been just a combination for me that I am forever grateful for.
I'm just sort of wondering why women and children? Because clearly there were so many causes to think about, right?
Well, I think part of it came out of the work that I had done at House of Ruth.
Right.
And also, LA is the homeless capital of the United States. And the number in terms of unhoused folks has remained almost the same. And the fastest growing number is women and children. Also, my sister had gone through a pretty challenging time when she faced being unhoused herself. And there's this great quote from Marilyn James, who's an indigenous woman, who says, "We can't be a t-shirt activist. You need to find an issue that sticks like a washcloth in your throat." And I thought that's such a powerful image. And I think each one of us needs to find a place where we're passionate. And thank you for all the collaborations that we do with each other, because there's so many issues, as you just said. But how do you locate yourself to be able to continue the work for justice?
Absolutely. So Judy, share with us, what kind of conflicts did you encounter and how did you navigate your way through them?
Well, the conflicts, that's very interesting. I'm laughing because the conflicts come sometimes from trying to help people understand, especially major donors that may have not that proximity that is so important. There's a lot of stereotypes, there's a lot of biases. But I know for myself, I had folks who were willing to teach me, who were willing, I guess, saw enough in me to say, okay, we've got to talk a little here about white privilege, and we have to talk here a little bit about economic security and what are some of the things that happen when folks just don't know where their next dollar is going to come from. So I think the challenges for me is trying to work with folks to open their hearts and their minds to counteract all those things. And I think it's designed by this system to keep people feeling separated, to blame those who are just struggling to survive, who fail to see the systemic obstacles in really getting ahead, and to help folks understand the work at Alexandria House is really justice work. There's an inequity in terms of services and resources and income in this society that has to be addressed. And sometimes quick, but usually slow process, because we all have to undo a lot of what bell hooks called the colonization of the mind in terms of why we are who we are, and legitimate some really unjust ways of being together. So we get about 1,000 calls a month now of we've grown, but even at the beginning, we would get a lot of calls. And so we would do an initial interview over the phone and then have folks come and see the place and see how they felt. And if I ask the question, what is your main concern about living? Sometimes women would say living with other women. And at first it surprised me. But then when you think about it, keeping women separated for whatever reason and however, a male-dominated society does that, it's to keep the power that comes out of women coming together as a collective from really being a strength for change. So we have a weekly meeting, and part of that is sharing stories. And then there's that aha moment when there's a connection. So even though we may have a different color skin, even though we may speak a different language, there's that moment when we see we really have something in common as women that can make us stronger together precisely because we are diverse and we do have different ways of being and thinking and operating that can support each other and also can then communicate that as a possibility to other people.
You know, what I'm finding so interesting is that at one level there was homelessness, and at another level there was still that clarity in what is it that we don't want, right? I mean, that's the part which sort of stared me in the face.
And that's a really important point because often now, because we have a thrift store in the back and, people bring donations. And that perspective, what you just said, is, people should just be happy with what they get. And I think it's probably for me out of a gospel story that those who have the least deserve the very best. And I learned that myself. And so we wanted our house to be beautiful. We want everything that can remind a person who may have not even learned it yet that they are valuable and beautiful and loved in themselves. I think the other piece is we have kids and we want it to be as home-like as possible. And I have to give credit to my sister, my middle sister, who was struggling. And when I started the work way back at House of Ruth, I said, Chris, what do I need to know? And she said two things. First, when somebody arrives at the house, don't expect them to hit the ground running the next day because so much of your energy goes to keeping your kids safe. And the second is the more power you can give to people over their own lives, the faster the healing process. And so everybody gets a key to the front door. We don't lock up the refrigerator. People can eat when they want to eat. We have dinner together Monday through Thursday. Better than that, some folks love to cook their meals for their kids. And, we really have, hopefully, we say, a house of hospitality where people feel welcomed and know they are a part of a community. And also, we're a neighborhood center, so people will come, and it's really sort of an oasis in a very busy and sometimes so rushed, not a time to be friendly city.
I love that gospel story, Judy. Thank you for sharing this. I think that's just so beautiful that from get-go, you're giving them almost like a feeling that they've come to their place, which they rightly deserve.
Absolutely, that's beautifully put. And, Michelle Richards, who was on staff here, she used to say to people, here everyone gets and everybody gives. And that's everybody has an opportunity to share in some way. And we all receive something. One day I had just a really simple cold and cough. And meanwhile, I had four different people offering me teas. So, or home medicine remedies that were sure to fix. I get so much out of living here. I get a clarity, a vision. I am amazed and in awe and grateful for living here and raising my daughter here. And it's that kind of connections that really builds a sense of community and safety and wanting to stay involved. So we have a monthly meeting of alumni. They come to do some free shopping in our thrift store. They come for breakfast, but most of all, they come because it's a sense of community, support, home, friendship, and respect. And I hope we never lose that.
I can only imagine them wanting to come back to their safe haven, so to speak.
Yes.
Judy, for the benefit of the global listener, give us a little overview of this housing crisis, which is sort of at the heart of what you're doing.
Yeah, well, what we have in LA, wealthy apartments that only folks can afford who are making way more than minimum wage. And I don't have the statistics exactly right, but people would need to work three jobs if you're working a minimum wage job. No one can afford the rent. And so we got Section 8 vouchers, but now owners know that in LA, they can get so much more than what the housing authority or HUD is willing to pay. So they find other ways not to honor the Section 8 voucher, like you have to make three times the rent, even though, most people can't do that. I don't think our staff could even do that. And meanwhile, units are being built that nobody can afford. And there's a vacancy rate that is just very high. And meanwhile, there is very little affordable housing being built. So there's just a housing scarcity that won't be remedied in 10 years, won't be remedied unless some radical changes happen. There's also a law or a policy that says new owners need to ensure that 10% of their units go as affordable, but you can get out of that by making a contribution to this fund, and nobody knows where this fund is that is supposed to support services for those who are unhoused. Right now the hospitality workers are moving through a strike because the folks who work in hospitality and the hotels have to travel hours of time to get here because they don't have an option of living in the city and close to where they work. And also wanting to gentrify downtown, there's been a push to move everyone who used to come together in what was called the Skid Row area to move them out. Incarceration has been one kind of affordable housing, and now it's private industry that's making money. So you'll find encampments now in almost any neighborhood. And of course, the folks get blamed for bringing down the value of the neighborhood are the very folks that are just trying to find a place and a neighborhood to live themselves. And it's a huge crisis. Our mayor now, Karen Bass, called it a humanitarian crisis in LA. But I think until there's really a political will and a moral mandate to do something concrete and radical in terms of really creating affordable housing, it's not going to be solved.
That was very helpful. You know, from there, then the question which comes to my mind, Judy, is that to be told this is a transition home, you know, eventually you have to get out. I'm sure that there must be like an intentional program which sets them for success, yet they feel motivated to, you know, sort of get started from get-go.
That's a great question. And yes, it is a program. And that's one of the reasons we do the face-to-face interview, because we want to have time to go through the program. I think one of the key components is a savings program. We try to meet people's expenses when they come, like if you need diapers or toiletries or food, that we try to provide that so that at least a third of whatever your income needs to go into savings, so that you can begin to build up some money so that you're ready to move. And we also meet to hear, what are your dreams? You know, if you were to come, we'd ask, like, what is your vision, what you want for yourself? Education is really a strong priority, because to make more than a minimum wage job, education for many want to complete their high school degree or go on do a career track. So they meet once a month with check-ins pretty regularly. We also provide counseling, because many folks are dealing with trauma. So that's a part of the program. So it is a program, but it's also along with that home-like as much as we possibly can. And the other thing that just happened with us with COVID, a lot of the women that we knew who had been the most recently hired were the first to be let go. And so the question becomes, well, then now how are you going to pay your rent? And we started what's called our Startup Sisterhood LA program. It's an entrepreneurship program, because women have dreams. One is to have a job, but the other is to have like a career or, you know, a skill that you want to put into business. And now we've had five cohorts that have moved through it, and we promote their businesses. And we have someone who comes in and teaches basic business language. Sometimes that conversation hasn't taken place in families growing up because of all the other things that are needing to be attended to. But as a transitional residence program, folks can stay up to 2 years, but the average length of stay is a little over a year and a month. And we make exceptions.
Right. So Judy, I'm just wondering, since you said a lot of them, you know, come from Central America also and so on, right? So does that mean they're refugees?
So when I worked in House of Roots, given it was located in Boyle Heights and given what was happening, especially in Central America at the time, a number were immigrants often seeking political asylum.
Right.
But here in LA, and we're in what is called Koreatown, now renamed Little Bangladesh, with a number of Latinx, you know, cultures represented, folks from Central South America, Latin America, and we're sort of committed to it, a diversity of folks. The one time we had 18 first languages represented in the house and folks receiving services. And, you know, that diversity here at Alexandria House is very reflective of the global community of which we are a part. It's just really rich in terms of culture, but also stories connect in terms of the trauma, in terms of needing to relocate and wanting to raise their kids in a safe environment where they're not afraid that they're going to be conscripted into military service or killed on the street. And, you know, in LA, we have some of those same issues. We all just need to work together and learn from each other and do better for our kids.
Yeah, you know, that's what stands out for me the most, Judy, that we are having a conversation across a Zoom call, but in a country which is supposedly a superpower, right? And yet we are talking about such heartbreaking stories or situations and so on.
And we have that here. I mean, Black Lives Matter is created by, and so many members are moms who have lost their kids to the police and to killing. And being a United States person, we need to, and maybe is happening, but I don't know, humble ourselves to recognize that not only do we perpetrate some of these problems, but also the majority of people here in the United States are just struggling to make it. And then you have a potential president who speaks hatred and blame and sets up as enemies some of our very own neighbors. We have a lot of work to do. So I guess that's why I'm passionate.
Yeah, the universe is lucky to have people like you, Judy, because not everyone is so selfless. We're talking about women from all kinds of cultures, right? And you said that probably the only common language is Spanish, which you don't speak. And you said that you create this weekly platform where they come and share their stories and find the commonalities. How do you bridge that language barrier?
Well, a lot of folks, the language of the colonizer, know English, even if it's their second language, because you need to do that to survive. So if someone, for whatever reason, has not learned English, then we really work to be able to find a way to share. I've had a lot of miracles, and two of my favorite stories in the world are about a woman named Ruby, who came from Romania, and Ada, who was Puerto Rican. And when Ada got there first, and she was pregnant, and then Ruby came, and she identifies as a Romanian gypsy. This was at House of Ruth. And Ada called me aside, and she said, she can't stay here. Ruby has to go. And I said, well, that's not going to happen, but can you tell me what's going on? And she said, well, about gypsies, they steal kids. So she was afraid for her babies. And she had a little girl, Diana. But what happened is they looked for a job together. They had to do dishes together, and they got to know each other. And when Ada went to go give birth to her second daughter, she asked Ruby to watch Diana. So, that's a miracle for me, and I just love it. And then we had a woman, her name was Pammy. She came profoundly deaf, could not find any shelter that would take her. And so we invited her to come. We acknowledged that not many of us knew too much sign, but she was desperate, so she came. And then very soon after that, we got a call from a woman. She had five kids. Her heritage was Mexican. She came. When I opened the door for the interview, she was signing to her driver, and she knew Mexican sign, American sign, Spanish, and English. And that's a miracle to me. Some would just say luck, maybe fate, that makes it possible to create community. But it takes risks. And I think I've been challenged by people to take risks, but it's also the joy that comes from doing the work.
Please share with me some of those medical stories and what kind of risks are we talking about?
Well, one of my favorite stories. And her name is Ima. She had been trafficked and managed to escape. And working with the Coalition to Abolish Slavery and Trafficking, I remember her sitting on the couch next to Posse, who also had been trafficked and came from Indonesia, and their connection. She eventually got a job and was very active with CAST and their survivors network. And time goes on, and she gave a lot of talks. She got a call that she would be willing to talk to this group, the DNC, and she immediately said yes and hung up. And her friend said, Ima, do you know what the DNC is? And she didn't. She said, that's the Democratic National Convention, and you're going to be talking to millions of people across the globe. And she did, and she did a phenomenal job. It was when Hillary Clinton was running. And now she lives behind us at Kenmore. And, just to watch her grow into this amazing woman who can speak to millions. And she was on President Obama's task force on human trafficking. I mean, that's just gives such joy to one's heart to see a person come into themselves. So That's part of those anecdotal stories. But then we had somebody who got out of DV situation. She had moved to Santa Maria with her partner. The police didn't believe it was that serious, and actually he shot her and she died in front of her son. That's just heartbreaking. And society isn't always really good to especially young men of color, and so the so-called justice system isn't fair. So it's watching moms trying to navigate and make sure that especially their teenage boys, also girls, but teenage boys stay safe, stay out of the system, because those who have just seem to get more, and those who don't have to hang on so tightly to any little thing that they get. And I have to do a shout out, even though she's no longer living, to Molly Lowry, who worked in the downtown area. And her sort of motto was whatever it takes for as long as it takes. So, folks know they have a place here. And I was just at my daughter's commencement, and that was one of the things that the person doing the commencement address talked about is failure. That's what we name it, but really it's just gives a person a clearer understanding to the next step for success. But how often do we really say, well, what didn't work this time? We love you, rather than here they go again, or it's one more time. It's like if we could drop that out and really say, what did we learn? And then congratulations for getting back up. And how do we recognize the saints in our midst who, made a bad decision? And maybe it's their second one or fifth one or seventh one, but they got back up, and that's a hero.
Judy, you're so positive and my God, so selfless, right? But there must have been moments when you found it overwhelming. And then what did you do to get yourself back on track?
Yeah, that's a really important question. I think probably one of the most heartbreaking, hardest jobs. We get 1,000 calls a month from folks who we're not able to welcome here at the house. And to try to find resources, and this is probably conservative, but 84,000 homeless people, 11,000 shelter beds. Any way you do the math, there's not enough places for everybody. The fastest growing number of folks who are unhoused are single women with kids. That's really hard. In some ways, it just makes me want to work harder to, but it gets to a point, especially on a weekend, Friday night, late at night, you get a call from a mom. I'm just been released from the hospital. I have a 3-day baby. I'm living in my car. The stories are just heartbreaking. So what do you do? And, I had a good friend who worked in El Salvador, and he said, if you're committed, it will break your heart. But on the other hand, it's also finding the joy that comes from everyday living. And I am reading a book by Thich Nhat Hanh on how to relax. So, it doesn't get solved overnight. And the other for me is I put it in God's hands in the end. And it will be what it is. And I have to believe that. I just have to. I asked my dad one time, I said, well, how do you know there is a God? And his response is, maybe there is, maybe there isn't, but you have to make a decision on how you want to live your life. And this is how I'm choosing to live my life. And if the end, if there isn't, well, so be it. It's over. And in the end, if there is, well, let's all celebrate. See what the next birth into the other side of time actually looks like.
I actually read this very tiny little book, which I keep by my bedside, called The Present, right? So it's metaphorical. The cover shows a little gift box. But really, the biggest takeaway from the book was just focus on the present, right? So, what I'm hearing is focus on the amazing work Alexandria is doing, because you can only do this much, right?
Yeah, a lot of people have said it in different ways. You just said it beautifully. It's like how you break down survival sometimes when you're confronted with what feels like I'm not going to make it is make it through the day
Right.
or make it through the minute. And my sister taught me about tides. You know, it comes in, the pain, the grief, but it goes out. And I think one of the things that comes from getting older is that you see that you've been able to ride the tides. You know, when you're young, I think it seems overwhelming and you'll not get through it. And this is like you're going to drown in the sadness and the grief. But I think we learn that we can ride the tides. And that's something I think it's important to share and help younger people look for, even in their own lives.
So, shifting to some happier moments, share with us how you co-parented Renishan. I know you brought her when she was only 4 days old, and you're co-parenting her with another staff member. So, how did Sister Judy become a mother?
Well, yes. And how it really happened is we had a woman here. Her name was Bridget, and she worked through the program. She became a CNA. She was taking care of someone. She lived here with her a daughter and a son, Randy and Ryan, and they were 7 and 8. She was taking care of the person. He wanted something from 7-Eleven. Her car was raggedy. She went in. When she came back, somebody had gotten into the car and attacked her. So she took herself to the hospital. That meant the babysitter, because it, you know, USC County was slow, left the kids alone. Somebody called DCFS. They picked up the kids. The kids said, "We want to go to Alexandria House." The police called, but they wouldn't let us get the kids because none of us were trained in the foster care system. So it took Bridget 6 months to get her kids back when all she wanted to do was leave the hospital and go home and cuddle with her kids. I mean, that's a heartbreak. So another staff person, Teresa, and I decided we're not going to ever have this happen again. So we went through the MAP training so that we were qualified if it ever happened again. But Teresa decided that she's good with teenagers. She had two older kids, and that she would begin to do fostering in her home. So she did, but one day she got a call that there was a 4-day-old little girl at Sentinel Hospital that they had no place to place her. And would Teresa ever consider, you know, taking an infant? And she called me because we're very good friends. And at first I said, "This is going to be a lot of work, right? A baby." So I remember saying to her, "But why don't you just go to the hospital and see what you think?" Now, who is going to go to the hospital and see a 4-day-old little baby and say, "Ah, no, didn't work that way." So Renisha came into our lives, and Ray actually grew up here, lived here, and I think it was a miracle for me. I thought I knew kids. I thought I understood the bond between a mother and a child. I remember the moment that Renisha and I bonded. She was actually sleeping in a box because it was so fast. We had to pick her up that night. And Teresa went to fix the bottle and she was crying. And I thought, "Oh, now what do I do?" And I know the moment we bonded. And it has taught me so much more about that mother-child relationship that makes moms, especially when they're under threat, just go into protective mode for their kids and how much kids feel what their parents are feeling. So she's truly an Alexandria House child. The village there was, you know, there to celebrate her college graduation. She had her adopting family, and then she had all the families here. Some of you can't tell her that some of the folks she grew up with here are not her cousins or her brother or sister. But I think she's my greatest gift.
Beautiful.
And when she turned 18, we had gotten several tattoos together. You know, I figured she was getting a tattoo. And also, I wanted to get a tattoo because that's one of those stereotypical things, probably like 20 years ago. But if, you know, when I turned 65, I got a tattoo because I was tired of people saying, "Well, look, they have tattoos." And I said, "Well, I have a tattoo. So, you know, what's the problem?" But she called me on the phone and she said, "Mom, guess what you got me for my 18th birthday?" And so I said, "Well, that's interesting. What?" And she said, "You got me a tattoo." And I know how expensive they can be. But I had presence of mind to say, well, what does it say, Ray? What did you get? And she said, I got DNA does not make a family, love does. And, you know, it shut me up. And I guess that's true across the board. Redefine it at its deepest level so that we understand folks who are unhoused are truly our brothers and sisters. So that's Ray, and I'm just so proud of her. And she's one of God's great gifts to me.
Beautiful, Judy. So after dedicating over 28 years to Alexandria House's mission, what's next for Judy?
You know, I've been grappling with this. So I think a quick answer is, one is living day by day and seeing. Being a feminist, I had some trouble with, you know, some of the interpretations of scripture passages, and definitely the institutional Catholic Church has I have some trouble with some of their decisions, but I went back to gospel music. And there's this beautiful song by Donnie McClurkin that he sings with the Winans, and it's stand. Like, when you've done all you can, then you just stand. You show up, you do the work, and I'll know. I know I will know at some point what the next step is. So I pray and I watch and I listen. And, you know, right now there's tons to be done in a lot of places, and where I should be next, I'm not sure. But for right now, I'm here and I love the place, and I love the people I meet, who I live with, who I work with. And I've been blessed with good health, knock on whatever. So keep your fingers crossed. So we'll see. But right now I'm doing sort of day by day.
Absolutely. Before we end the call, what's the one leadership mantra would you like to share?
There used to be, I don't hear it so much anymore, servant leader. But I do think it's someone who can juggle a lot of things in the air. But I just think it's recognizing the strengths of each person on the team and being grateful. I swear that maybe it's, in the end, the one word would be gratitude.
Which is something I heard all through the conversation, Judy. Thank you very much, Judy. This was absolutely beautiful. And I learned so much today, and I really appreciate all that you've shared.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for your time and for getting the word about not only Alexandria House and the work, you know, and me, but you've done some amazing podcasts that keep us all connected and learning. So thank you for that.
Thank you for being a part of this incredible journey with Atlanta Diaries. I have had the privilege of hosting guests who courageously shared their most vulnerable selves with me. And even if only a small segment of these conversations can champion the journey of one person, it will be worth each and every moment. And together, we know we can create an even greater impact. So I do have a humble request for you. If you found value in these episodes, please consider sharing the podcast with your friends, family, and on your social media. I would also love to hear your thoughts, and will really appreciate if you could take a moment to leave a review or rating. See you next week for another inspiring journey on Atlanta Diaries.